We'll conclude this hour by noting how policy changes made, many of them secretly in the wake of the 9/11 attacks, retain a capacity to shock even 13 years after the formal war on terror began. We continue now with reporter James Risen, who awaits his fate in a case where he is being compelled by the Justice Department to testify against his sources, something he refuses to do. If anything, his latest book is an unabated continuation of his mission to lift the secrecy veil, hiding the implications of the war on terror. Pay any price, greed, power, and endless war. Risen says the Obama administration has made permanent a war footing that the American public will be paying for generations.
My book was really my answer to the government. I say in the afterword of the book, you know, the writing this book and continuing to investigate the war on terror is my answer to the Obama administration's continuing to target me. And feel like I have to show that I'm going to keep writing and keep investigating.
Are you fighting for freedom of speech or just for your own freedom? Or are you caught in some just kind of Kafkaesque bureaucracy that almost has no meaning?
Well, I think I'm fighting for press freedom in America. I think the Obama administration turned this case into a confrontation over press freedom when they appealed the judge's decision on my subpoena. The original judge had quashed their subpoena, and the Obama administration appealed that decision to the Court of Appeals. And in their appeal, they said flat out, there is no such thing as a reporter's privilege in a criminal trial, which is a way of saying we don't believe in press freedom. We don't believe that investigative reporting has a real role in our society. So I felt like I didn't have any choice but to fight that.
What is their argument that you're doing to hurt America?
You have to ask them. I think they are – you had it right a minute ago. They're caught in a bureaucratic Kafkaesque thing. They've got this system now which is really bad for democracy, in which the CIA and the Director of National Intelligence have the authority to file criminal referrals to the Justice Department on any story that they think there has been a leak of classified information, which gives them the arbitrary right to decide which stories they don't like and then get the Justice Department to open a criminal investigation of. All these leak cases are initiated by the intelligence community. And the intelligence community is supposed to be a foreign intelligence agency without a role in domestic policy or politics. But this process puts them directly into domestic politics. It gives them the right to initiate a government crackdown on the American press. And that's what they've been doing throughout the Obama administration. They've had more leak investigations, more prosecutions than any administration ever before. And when you have a system in which you give the intelligence community the right to start criminal investigations of journalists and of whistleblowers, you're making the intelligence community its own political constituency.
You know, part of the subtitle of this book is Power and Endless War. Right. The Cold War, and you describe this a little bit, is, you know, an endless war, and Dwight Eisenhower warned all about that. Mm-hmm. How would you compare the endless communist war with the endless war on terror?
What we now have, I think, in the war on terror is a homeland security industrial complex, which is different from the military industrial complex. It's more about pouring hundreds of billions of dollars into intelligence contractors and counterterrorism contractors, companies that do secret work for various secret agencies. And so it's much more difficult for the American people to see what's happening. In the Cold War, there were congressional debates that were open in public about defense budgets and missiles and things like that. We don't have an open public debate at all today. And one of the things that's happened is over 13 years, we've had this very open-ended involvement in a war on terror, which is kind of like the war on drugs. I mean, terror is an abstraction. It's easy to define victory or defeat or continued operations in however you want to do it. And because there's very little oversight, We have this new national security apparatus that's grown since 9/11 far beyond anyone realizes it.
And, you know, part of that, you know, lack of debate means that, you know, it's almost unspeakable to bring up this subject. How would you say the communist threat, the Warsaw Pact threat, the tanks that were lined up in Europe, stacks up against guys with hoods and knives and the other, you know, maniacs who constitute this very well televised threat called ISIS and the terrorists of the world?
You know, the problem is that we have allowed ourselves to become the captives of our own fears. And, you know, granted, some of these terrorists are dangerous people, but they don't represent an existential threat to the United States. They don't represent an imminent threat to the United States. And we have allowed ourselves to engage in 13 years of fear-mongering and hyperbole and panic, frankly, that has given the government and these secret agencies carte blanche to do whatever they want to do to grow dramatically with no debate. And that's really the tragedy to me. Every politician who wants to raise any skepticism about the war on terror is immediately called soft on terror. And they're
or unpatriotic.
Down. Right.
Unpatriotic. You have a lot of anger, it seems, for President Obama in this book. I mean, there was a lot of anger for George W. Bush because he went after you, you know, with a chainsaw of lawyers. And but I think the way in which you claim that Obama has enshrined and made permanent this national security establishment, I think inspires in the tone of this even more anger.
I think it's more outrage than anger.
Yeah,
I mean,
I
feel like when you investigate the government and that your job is to investigate constantly, which is what my job has been for my whole career, you see the flaws in people pretty fast. And I think the problem for Obama is that he decided early on in his presidency that he was going to focus – this is my opinion. This is why I think this happened. I think he decided he was going to focus on domestic policy, economic policy, healthcare policy, and that he didn't want to fight with the Republicans on national security policy. And I think he decided that continuing and extending and making permanent the national security state, the counterterrorism programs that Bush had put in place, protected one of his flanks politically. And I think that was his initial thought. And then as he got in to office and brought in many of the same people that Bush had had on national security, I think he began to realize that executive power is a great thing to have once you're the executive. So I think he has succumbed to the seductions of power.
Let's talk about those seductions. Do you feel them? The, you know, the Situation Rooms, the Clancy, you know, satellite drone views of people being wiped out.
That's something that the government tries to seduce the media with and does it fairly successfully, repeatedly. And that's one of the tragedies of the way the war on terror has been covered. Is because there's so little information about what's really going on, it's easy for the government, you know, to get their side of the story out and whatever story it is. And the financial problems in the media over the last, you know, 5 to 10 years would make it so there's not very many people covering this kind of thing anymore in any detail.
And so the picture from the Pentagon is like lead story.
Yeah.
Easy.
Yeah. It's much easier for them to get their message out than it would have been if the, you know, the press and the media wasn't going through such tumultuous times.
You know, a lot of what's written about in here is stuff that we're familiar with on a certain level, but it's sort of just nailed home. Paul Wolfowitz, you know, forgive me for talking about, you know, your prologue.
That's great.
Lots of people do that. But why do you think Wolfowitz has no apparent remorse, a sense of, boy, did I mess up here?
That is one of the great questions because
One
of the reasons I wrote that prologue is the way I did was I was trying to sit down with him and talk. And we talked a couple times. I had heard rumors. He did have second thoughts and doubts. Those were unconfirmed rumors, and I never was able to have any conversation with him in which he professed any second thoughts. But that led me to the prologue, which I love. I mean, I'm glad you brought that up because I went to see him and to see this Iraq Liberation Day celebration in, at Arlington National Cemetery, which I found to be an incredibly poignant thing to be there. It was Section 60, if you've ever been to Section 60 in Arlington, is where the dead of the Iraq War lay buried. And they are the freshest graves at Arlington. And it's very heartbreaking to go there because you see ribbons and photos of small children and wives all along the graves because they're so fresh. And they had on April 9th, 2009, the small band of pro-war supporters had a ceremony there for the sixth anniversary of the fall of Baghdad. April 9th, 2003 was the day the statue of Saddam fell in Fardos Square.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And 6 years later, after a very grim war, only about 50 people were there to celebrate. And they were the only people who still called that Iraq Liberation Day. And Paul Wolfowitz was there.
And meanwhile, in Baghdad, there were 30,000 people
protesting against the United States' continued involvement in the war.
It's just...
And so I was there really to see Wolfowitz, but then I realized that the ceremony was very interesting because Viola Drath, this aging socialite, was there as the master of ceremonies. And she had arranged for all these Iraqi diplomats and other people to be there and give little speeches. And then 2 years later, she was found murdered in her home by her husband, who dressed up as an Iraqi army general and who claimed that Nouri al-Maliki had made him a general. And I thought, this is like a little perfect metaphor for what the war on terror really is all about, which is you never know what's real and what's concoction in this war.
James Risen is an investigative reporter with our partner, The New York Times, and author of Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War. Hoping to get back some good feelings from veterans, the Department of Veterans Affairs is announcing a major overhaul of its health care system in advance of Veterans Day. Pink slips for bad apples.
If 1,000 people need to go, give me a sense of what are some of the things that they did.
Well, we're simplistically talking about people who violated our values.
And those values are what?
It's integrity. It's advocacy. It's respect. It's excellence. These are the things that we try to do for our veterans.
New VA Secretary Bob McDonald on CBS's 60 Minutes. As we approach Veterans Day, how do we make up for our past failures to our veterans who've made ultimate sacrifices? And is the VA equipped to take on this challenge? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, broadcasting from the studios of KUOW in Seattle. This is The Takeaway.